accession number 11127, reel 3.
The Colmanist by 1958 or 59. In 1952, when I came back to England, there are times during my early service with the Malayan Scouts, I had been so depressed that I thought the whole thing would probably wrap up, maybe should. By the time I actually came back to England, I was convinced that the idea was sound. All that really mattered now was to try and get things right. One of the first and obvious essentials was that we must select from volunteers, select men who were going to be suitable, because one of our problems certainly had been caused by the fact that we were getting unsuitable soldiers out to the regiment, and though they could and in some cases were returned to their own units, RTU'd, it was a stupid and wasteful procedure anyway and disruptive inside the unit. And in 1952 I was available before I joined the Dorset Regiment's Territorial Army, and I was asked to go to Aldershot, take charge of the volunteers who were still being collected in the Airborne Forces depot there, and to work out some form of selection training. And I did this by taking them to Wales. It was all very difficult because there was no establishment for it. We had no transport, and all we could do was to get unsuitable rations out of the cookhouse, unsuitable, that is, for carrying on your back around the countryside, and rail warrants to somewhere in Wales. And the very first course that was ever run lasted only a week, and we went to Snowdonia, where I put these volunteers through some training in elementary tactics and map reading, and also some physical stress. Unfortunately, most of the physical stress was on me, because in the middle of it I developed malaria. But I did begin to realize that selection was going to be had to be set up on a properly organized basis. And in a report that I wrote at the time, this was accepted. And General Miles Dempsey, who was then Colonel Commandant of the SAS, came to see me at Airborne Forces Depot, and he was a great help in seeing the then Commandant, Colonel Pine Coffin, the Commandant of the Airborne Forces Depot, and saying that we were very unhappy at the way the volunteers had been treated in Airborne Forces Depot at that time. He hoped that setting up a proper selection procedure would be supported, and it's fair to say that the Airborne Depot from that time on were supportive of the SAS, though still very much looked down upon them, mainly because at that time they were not trained parachutists, and certainly in those days obviously the importance of parachuting to the parachute regiment was very great indeed, and the SAS were wearing the red beret and they were not parachutists, and it's understandable that they were very hostile in fact to the SAS volunteers there. And even I, who was not a parachutist either at that time, found that some people were very unpleasant, but of course there are always exceptions. And generally, from that time onwards, Airborne Forces gave increasing help and support to the SAS, and done so ever since.
So,
the sort of man we were looking for at that time was one who was really determined, and that was perhaps, at that time, the first consideration. And for that reason, we put them under great physical pressure, long marching and so on, until they were exhausted, and tried to see whether they were still determined to join the SAS. But we did also, at that stage, need to have men who were intelligent, certainly intelligent enough to be able to read a map and look after themselves. And the other side of selection, apart from physical pressures on them, was to see whether they were the sort of men who were sufficiently intelligent to do that. And right from that very early stage, too, we emphasized that there had to be self-discipline, that unlike the armed forces as a whole, where the private soldier level, certainly in those days, were expected to do what they were told to do, but were not expected to do anything unless they were told what to do, we were, even at that stage, we were looking very much for men who would act on their own initiative. And that, right from the beginning, was very important to us. And equally important was self-discipline. It was a rule from those early days, and I remember making it a rule in my squadron, that no troops were to be inspected before they went on operations, which was the normal and really very sensible army practice of inspecting all soldiers to see that they had got all their equipment and all their kit and all their rations and ammunition and everything else before they went on operations. Right from the start, the SAS soldiers were told, that is your responsibility, and unless you turn up with all the right kit, you're no good to us, because nobody is going to be a nanny and run around and tell you what to do. So once you've been trained what you're to do and where you're to be at a certain place, that is it. And we shall tell you that you've got to be on a lorry at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning at such and such a place. If you're not there, the lorry goes at 6 o'clock and you'll be left behind, and as far as we're concerned, you're left behind forever, because we shan't want to see you again. And so that sort of training, if you like to call it training, of self-discipline started at selection and was carried on, of course, in the Red. In 1952, 22 SAS regiment had been in existence for 2 years in Malaya. In England, 21 SAS regiment had been formed from the Artist Rifles in 1947. And that regiment, by 1952, was training with a role in the operational role in the Middle East. In 1952, the Army Z Reserve was called out in part. These were wartime soldiers, all, of course, with experience of fighting in the Second World War. And in 1952, the SAS called up part of their Z Reserve, I think about two squadrons. And I was asked if I would go for the period of this camp at Otley in Yorkshire, if I would go and join. And I was asked if I would go for the period of this camp at Otley in Yorkshire, if I would go and join the Z Reserve. I, of course, said yes, because I thought what interesting and useful experience it would be for me. When I arrived at Otley, I was very shaken to be told, John, you're to go out and take command of one of the Z Reserve squadrons. I was very shaken, because I had not served in the SAS in the war. I was not a parachutist. And by this time, I had a pretty good idea of what the SAS had done in the war, and was naturally somewhat in awe of these chaps who had served in the wartime SAS. However, what actually happened was, when I commanded this squadron, they were very kind to me, and I learned a great deal, inevitably, of how SAS operations in Europe in particular had been carried out. And it was immensely instructive to me, and of course it again opened my eyes, and I think my imagination, to thinking of the future after Malaya, and at what had been accomplished against the Germans in Western Europe could be adapted, if necessary, if there should ever be a war with the Soviet Union. And my thinking started really at that stage to line up a possible future for 22 SAS in Europe. In 1955, I went back to 22 SAS to find Colonel George Lee in command, and the squadrons at that time were A, B, and D, the Rhodesians having returned to Rhodesia, and we were also joined by a squadron from the parachute regiment, who came out and were formed and trained to operate like the SAS squadrons in Malaya. In 1955, the SAS, of course, were trained and equipped solely for operations in Malaya. At that time, there were no other operational role, indeed no other training, other than the beginning of some training in raiding airfields in cooperation with the RAF. And for the first time in the middle 50s, training did begin in military operations which were not concerned with the communist terrorists. However, these were very much a sideline and rather a sort of short-term diversion between jungle operations. I found, of course, that the regiment had developed in the time that I had been away, that there were now many men who were quite experienced. There were many men who spoke Malay. There were a considerable improvement in the training of medical orderlies.
This is Colonel John Woodhouse, tape 3.
In 1955, when I went back to Malaya, I went back to command a squadron. It happened to be a D squadron that Colonel Lee gave me command of. I'd had 2 years when I was adjutant of the Dorset TA battalion. I'd had 2 years to reflect on operations in Malaya and what had gone wrong in particular. And by the time I came back to Malaya, I had a very clear idea of what we should be doing out there and where we had gone wrong. And in Colonel George Lee, I found a commanding officer who was very keen to put right the disciplinary, the operational disciplinary side. By that time, certainly out of operations, the regiment was well behaved and well disciplined, and administratively very sound. I think Colonel Lee was a bit concerned that the battle discipline was still slack in some parts of the regiment. And he talked to me before I commanded D Squadron. He was then living in the mess, and we had long discussions, rather as I had with Colonel Calvert. And we seemed to be very much of a mind on tactics and discipline. And Colonel Lee gave me command of this squadron. And I think perhaps my contribution in the next 2 years, when I was commanding D Squadron, was twofold. One was I was so almost obsessed by our failures in the Malayan Scouts, so obsessed with the necessity to have the highest possible battle discipline standard, that I was very ruthless with people who fail to live up to this. And Colonel Lee would always back us up, squadron commanders, if we said somebody was not up to scratch. And this applied particularly, of course, to the officers, because if the officers weren't right, obviously nothing else was going to be right. And we did, unfortunately, have to remove a number of people, and we probably removed one or two people who shouldn't have been removed. But if we erred, we erred on the side of severity. And by taking this very strict line...
Can you give me an example? I mean, can you... I didn't mean names, but...
I think what if, for example, I went to visit a troop, and if I found some signs of their presence in the form of, say, a ration tin lying on the track or in the campsites, it was quite obvious that British troops had been there. I naturally sent for the troop commander for an explanation, and unless he had a very remarkable explanation of somebody being attached to him who was untrained or something who was responsible for it, if this happened more than once, he was out. And of course this attitude, the severity of the, there wasn't any new in the attitude, but the severity with which it was enforced was perhaps new. And I think it did cause people to sit up with a bit of a jerk and to realize that only the very top standards were going to be good enough, or we wouldn't survive in the regiment. It was not too uncommon, I'm sorry to say, for shots to be fired by accident in the jungle. This is not really so terrible, perhaps, because in the jungle you only had a half second to see someone, and you couldn't see more than 20 yards anyway, and it was quite easy to mistake the move of a monkey or something in the some sound in the trees for the presence of a terrorist. And naturally weapons were loaded, and there were occasions when stumbling through the jungle safety catches came off, and a shot was fired by mistake. And there were, regrettably, one or two cases where shots were fired by mistake, where someone else was killed on our own side. And so the importance of stopping this, so far as it's humanly possible to do, hardly needed emphasizing. My own way of stopping it, or of any form of callousness in the jungle, short of RTUing the individual concern, was, which means returning them to their own units and in fact sacking them, sending them away. My own methods were for callousness in camp, bad procedure, battle discipline procedures, were to send the individual concerned out of the camp, some 50, 60 yards away, on his own, in the jungle, where he had to listen because there was no one near him, and would be too afraid, in my opinion, to just go to sleep again. And on occasion, I also, on one occasion, made one soldier take out a grenade and hold that in his hand without the pin in it as a sentry. Again, I think, as far as I remember, through callousness in handling grenades. I think the second contribution that perhaps I made to the regiment was that in 1955 there was very little written down. We had no standard operational procedures in writing, and Colonel Lee was very keen to encourage the interchange of ideas between different squadrons and to make sure that this got passed on. And during 1955 and 56 I produced whole series of operational notes for the squadron under the sort of headings a base is to be a hive and not a nest and things like that, which I think encouraged people to do what Mike Calvert had taught me. It encouraged my troop commanders to be in my mind and to think the same way as I did. And by having tactical exercises on paper when we were not in operations with the senior NCOs and the officers in the squadron, and setting theoretical paper exercises, we started, tried to start, stimulating tactical thought and how we should develop in Malaya. It was in Malaya, from studying, as obviously we had to, the communist theories of insurrection and political theories. It was in Malaya that I was very impressed by reports from surrendered or captured enemy personnel of the terrorist self-criticism sessions, which, as I understood it, meant that in the camp of an independent terrorist platoon, the commander would encourage individuals to say where and how they thought operations had gone wrong or right, and that this was conducted in a sort of circle or group, simply in a way chaired by the commander. I was impressed by this and thought that there was much to be said for it, and did the same thing in my squadrons, where I encouraged troops with their troop commander to sit down and talk freely about what was happening. This was best done not in a sort of military training period between 10 and 11 a.m. It was best done very informally, because when we were not on operations, we frequently went off to a camp on the beach where we did some shooting training and minor tactical training, but also the officers and men in the evening would be sitting drinking beer around a campfire or things like that. And it was in that sort of atmosphere, on occasion, obviously not all the time, but on occasion, that these discussions could be developed. Really, it was an early form of think tank, only, of course, in the military context.
I'm very interested in that. Can you talk about that, too?
Yes. Yeah. Of course, as a regular soldier and an infantry officer, I conformed, as one should and does in the regular army and in the Dorset Regiment, to the disciplinary procedures of the day. And it was new to me, and I think it was probably true to say that it was in the SAS or possibly in the special boat service of the Royal Marines that this sort of discussion of where one's mistakes had been first came about. Certainly it happened pretty early in the SAS. I think it was happening as early as my first tour. It became rather more formalised and perhaps rather better organised in my second tour in 1955 onwards. And the fact is, of course, that you only learn useful lessons from mistakes. If the thing has gone right, there's really nothing to be learnt. It's from one's mistakes that you learn. And it's always difficult to admit one's mistakes, and one has to set a lead as a squadron commander, and obviously I couldn't expect the troop commanders or the NCOs to admit they were making mistakes, rather contrary to the whole of the army system at the time, unless I admitted mistakes. And so really these things had to start off by me saying where I had gone wrong, because that encouraged the junior officers to realise that it wasn't really so very terrible. And I used to point out to them that this sort of theory of the divine right of commanders, that you can do no wrong, has always actually been farcical, because I remembered only too well from my days as a private soldier that we all thought we knew, and I think we did know, when our officers were no good and when they were good. And the fact that they wouldn't admit their mistakes still didn't mean that we thought a bad officer was a good one. So all they were doing when they admitted to making mistakes was admitting the obvious. And what actually happens, of course, is that the soldiers would then give credit to a chap who admitted his mistakes and say, well, he may be a bit of a fool, but at least he knows it. In the 50s, it was pretty easy for officers to admit their mistakes to men. The men themselves were not very experienced, because they hadn't been in the regiment very long. The problem became increasingly great in the 60s and in later years, I believe, because by that time there were NCOs in the SAS with experience not just in Malaya but in Borneo and in training in Norway and Central Europe and America, who were very experienced. And you had the increasingly difficult problem of selecting the officers for the regiment, and inevitably the officers came into the regiment obviously without experience, and so the officers had to be trained, and they had the extremely difficult job of being put in command of a troop where the technical knowledge of the soldiers was great, very much greater than theirs in, for example, explosives or communications. And the fact their technical knowledge couldn't match that of their soldiers was one initial problem. But the second, of course, was that you got the old soldier syndrome of soldiers saying, well, we didn't do this in Borneo, or we didn't do this in Oman, or it was like this in Malaya. And you had to overcome that, and of course it wasn't easy. In Milan, in the middle 50s, the SAS was still, in terms of killing terrorists, which was the yardstick by which the army as a whole tended to measure success or failure, was still well down the league table. We had to... It was a great pity, perhaps, that so much emphasis was put on killing terrorists. It was understandable. After all, that was what the army was there to do. But, in fact, though the SAS, over the period of 9 years, I think, in Malaya, killed 108 terrorists, which was probably less than one or two outstanding units like the Suffolks and the Royal Hampshires and some of the Gurkha battalions achieved in probably in 2 or 3 years, a little unfair to measure SAS success by kill rates. The main achievement of the SAS, which was very gradual, a bit-by-bit achievement, was to win the support of the Aborigines. And there were many mistakes in the early 50s made over this whole question of the Aborigines. Unfortunately, after Calvert left, there were attempts made to resettle Aborigines. Whole tribes were uprooted, put into hutted camps